Welcome to Situational Awareness Tactics Podcast. This podcast provides the crucial art of understanding current elements in an environment to increase your safety and survival. Here's your host, forensic psychologist and consultant, Dr. Carlos.
Come back, everyone. Well, today we have a very special guest. You probably heard his name, Tim Larkin, especially if you follow our Situational Awareness podcast. He is one of the world's foremost experts on the subject of violence. As a former military intelligence officer, he was part of a beta group that redesigned his special ops personnel trained for close combat. Over the course of his 25-year career through his company, Target Focus Training, he has trained more than 10,000 people in more than 50 countries on how to deal with imminent violence, including elite combat units, celebrities, and high-status executives, law enforcement agencies, and high-net-worth families. Tim Larkin is also the author of the New York Best Time-Selling book, Survive the Unthinkable. And his book we're also going to be talking about is When Violence is the Answer, Learning How to Do What It Takes When Your Life is at Stake, folks. We've talked about this before on the show, the fight, flight, or freeze mode. We'll be talking about that. Before we get started, make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know we like it. So let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the show, Mr. Larkin. Welcome, sir.
How's it going?
Great. Thank you so much for being here. We truly appreciate it. Your book is all over the place.
Yeah.
This is a very popular book, and the Situational Awareness podcast. I know so many people who've mentioned the book. A lot of our guests have talked about it. Let me ask you this. What motivated you to write about it? And then we'll get into a little bit about your, before we get into that, how about tell us a little bit about your history? You had a very fascinating history when I was reading your book. You're trying to go into SOF, I think, at one point, and you had some challenges there. Tell us a little bit about your history. What got you motivated to get into the military and so forth?
Yeah, I was a Navy brat, moved around, ended up about 11, 12 years old. Moved to Coronado, California, was Navy housing there. My dad had a ship across the way. He was surface warfare. And my backyard, I could look out in the backyard through the chain link fence. There was a little highway, and across that highway was this huge building that had a huge obstacle course. And so my brother and I were a couple years apart. We were just like, oh yeah, that's where we're going. We're going to go over there. So went over there a couple of times, jumped the fence, they were actually impressed that we could get over barbed wire fences. but we got over there and we started playing on the, what turned out to be the US Navy SEAL, UDT, Bud's UDT, obstacle course. And so we were playing on it, as two little Navy brats and getting chased off all the time. Then we'd sit up in the dunes and watch the guys go. And that was my introduction to the SEAL teams. Nobody knew anything about it back then. It wasn't an organization that was talked about at all. Very few books on it. And it was highly discouraged if you were, especially an officer going in. But I was hooked. I had a lot of friends. I made a lot of friends as a young kid. And that I decided I couldn't get, I'm amazed that you get paid to do that. So I knew everything there was about training. I knew how to prepare. I'd been taking cold showers since I was like 13 years old. I truly did have an unfair advantage going in because I knew what was going on. I just had to get accepted. And that was the hard part. There was 2,500 people. I was an officer. My dad, that was the only deal I did with my dad is that I'd go in as an officer. And so I went to ROTC program. I was up against 2,500 people that had we all passed the application to get in to be officers, and there's only two slots. So I was one of the kids that got the two slots, and I did it through basically more because of my inside knowledge. I actually flew to Washington DC and I sat outside the detailer's office, and that's a whole other story, and they screwed with me. But I do believe it's because I knew where to go, I knew where the decision maker was, and I did this. Now, the reason I'm telling everybody this is because I was unstoppable. I go into training and it's not easy, but when you know how to do it, it's actually, nothing was a surprise to me in training. I was literally weeks away. I flew through my training. We won Hell Week, all the major events, no problem. I had about 3 weeks left. Back then, your third phase was dive phase. And, I went diving on a day where my ears were clogged and I kind of was pushing it. I ended up blowing my eardrum and you know, going into vertigo underwater, where you can't, you know, you have no sensation of up, down, anything. So literally I went in that short amount of time of making that dive, I went from the number one guy going to then SEAL Team 4, which is, if anybody watches Narcos or anything, that's where you wanted to go, because that was working South America and they were the only guys back then doing anything. And I was so full of myself. I was bigger, faster, stronger. And I liked rubbing it in everybody's face. I mean, I wasn't a jerk, but I certainly let people know. And this was the first time in my life I had ever been introduced to true injury to the human body. And what I mean by that is a structure or sensory system of your body is attacked in such a way that you have to respond to the trauma. And I had no control over my body. They said when my head hit the surface, and the only reason I did that was because I was able to find the toe line underneath, and I was able to pull myself up. I felt I was pulling myself 45 degrees to the bottom. But when I got to the top, they said my head was slapping against the water uncontrollably, blood coming out of my ears. I knew as soon as the corpsman looked at me that I was done. I just knew that was it, you know? And to me, I thought my whole life was over at that point, because it's the only thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to be in any other part of the Navy. It was total hubris, because I mean, the accidents and the attrition rate is so high in BUDS. It's really stupid not to have a plan B, but I didn't have a plan B. They loved me. They liked me enough to keep me in the community. And what they did was they sent me to intelligence school. I became a special operations intelligence officer working directly for NAVSPEC WARCOM, which is the Admiral's thing. I had no business being on that group. But it was a really interesting time. I mean, here I was, non-operational. I'll never get my Trident. I'm an intel guy, low man on the totem pole. And I thought, you know, this is the worst. Well, what was interesting was that group was looking to, you know, it was right after Berlin happened, the Berlin Wall came down. And these guys were all pretty, the Admiral brought together his best people, his most senior our most senior enlisted and officers, guys that had all seen combat, Vietnam era guys that had done a lot of missions for a lot of other agencies, because he knew things were going to change. And he was tasking these guys. He goes, okay, what's coming up in the next 20 years? What do we got to be prepared for? How do we have to change our training? One of the areas that we had to change our training in was they knew they're going to start putting hands on people again. That it wasn't just the big Russian bear we were against. And so you're going to have to learn hand-to-hand combat again in a more direct manner. We really hadn't seriously looked at it since Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And and so basically that's my short story. What happened was within that group, they liked me. I had a martial arts background from my Navy kid days. And because they liked me, they invited me to be part of this group that was looking to redo the way we trained hand-to-hand combat. It was cool. People from all over the world. We had some of the best instructors at the time were flying in. This is pre Gracie jiu-jitsu, but not, you know, the Gracies did come in towards the end. And it was interesting. But the funny part was we flying in these people from all over. I lived in Pacific Beach at the time in San Diego. My command was on the West Coast in Coronado. And I got a call from my DEA buddies one day, saying, hey, man, are you guys still doing that punchy, kicky stuff? You know, they just thought it was hilarious that we were doing hand-to-hand combat.
Punchy, kicky stuff.
Yeah, well, because it was pre-UFC, so everybody thought, like, whoa, you guys are warrior gunfighters. Why would you ever blah, 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 you know? And I understand that. I understand the thing. And my DEA buddies just like to give me a hard time because we give to them. But I said, yeah, you know, I gave him a choice word back. Yeah, you know, we are. And he goes, well, listen, there's this guy. He goes, he's down on Gresham Street. He goes, he's on like Gresham and Grand. Now I think he's really screwing with me, because this is literally like three blocks away from my apartment, you know, and down there. He goes, hey, he goes, he's an a-hole. He goes, but you get along with a-holes, so you'll probably like him. And that's a key comment, because that is something that I do think I'm very good at. I am very good at getting great information from very difficult people. And I find that people that often have the best information when it comes to your self-protection, your violent, you know, true violence, stuff like that, they're not the most socially agreeable people to deal with. But I've found it to be a skill set that served me well over the years and got me a lot of great information. I've learned a lot from these people. This individual he was talking about was exactly that. I walked by, I almost didn't come by. It was a dingy little studio, nothing going on, like 900 square feet. It had carpet. I was like, what is this? Only thing that got me to go back, they didn't have a class going on. The only thing that got me to go back was there was a trifold that he had taped to the top. Told a little bit about his background. And he mentioned that he was a member of 173rd Charlie Company in Vietnam. That got my attention. For those of your listeners that don't know, Charlie Company was like this experimental army group that they used that Westmoreland wanted to find out, hey, what happens when we keep people extended out in the jungle? This guy was a tunnel rat. I said, if nothing else, I want to meet him because he probably has some practical information for us. You know, maybe there's something I can get. I walk in the next day, and I had modified grooming standard based off of women. That just means I could keep my hair longer and everything. Right now, everybody kind of wears their hair short, so it's not a big deal. But back then, they were in the 80s, you know, you wanted to have a modified grooming standard so you could blend in with a lot of the civilian work that we did. So I looked like, you know, I basically looked like your typical San Diego surfer that went in there, and I kind of hung out and looked. I kept waiting. I figured this guy must be amazing. This guy's going to come on because there's no picture of him in that thing.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, he's a short, short dude, man. He's like, this guy walks out. He's a short dude. He's got an Aloha shirt on, jeans, flip-flops, you know. And I'm thinking it's the janitor, you know, that walked out in there. But he's got these kids, and they're all like college-age kids, and they're in traditional gis and stuff. But I'm watching these kids go, and what kept me there before he came out was I watched this one kid. This guy comes in to like, you know, do a takedown on him. He slams him in the side of the neck, comb grabs his hair, and out of nowhere comes a rubber knife, and he just starts stabbing him right away in very specific places. And I sat there and said, wow, that's exactly what I've seen on the streets, you know, real violence on the streets and stuff. I've never seen anybody actually train this way. This was different. I've seen knife fighting and all this other stuff. I go, okay. And we had some, you know, top weapons people come in, but I'm like, damn, this kid's he had like a yellow belt on. And I go, yeah, he moved better than anybody I've seen so far. So, you know, I had my ego in check because I've got multi-level black belts at this point. And but I'm realizing I don't know what that kid just did. And I don't know. I couldn't replicate that. So maybe there's something I can learn here. Sure enough, this guy comes out and he kind of whispers into this kid's ear. He makes a little adjustment here, nothing, boom. Comes over and sits down and he's just watching. And he noticed me and, you know, engaged me in a quick conversation. I didn't give him too much information about anything. I'm just looking. I said, yeah, I was doing the Korean arts for a while. I did judo boxing. I said, I was just looking for something different. I said, one of my friends told me about your school. Oh, okay. And so he just played it off. He could tell there's probably a little bit more there. So I trained for him for about 6 months. You know, and as I got to go with him, he's a combat vet. We talked and, you know, I said, hey, you know, I'd like to introduce you to some people. And we ended up doing that. I know for time wise, I'll go ahead and just wrap this up for you. But basically what happened was I took this guy who was like in a time capsule from Vietnam. And I brought him to the teams. I brought him to Spec Warcom where I was at, got him in a SCIF, which is just a compartmentalized information place. They debriefed him. They checked his bona fides. Everything was legit. And the first question they gave him out of the box was a question of a shipboarding incident that had happened years prior with then SEAL teams. What we'd call SEAL Team 6 back then. And nobody could solve it. And it was an issue where if you've ever seen the setup of a special operations team outside of a door, you know, they're all lined, they got the whole lineup and they're all going to go through. Well, in this version, they were going through the hatch, which is a door on a ship. And they were going in to take over the room that they were going into. The first guy made it in. The second guy got jammed up by a bad guy. And he held up everybody else and he grabbed the guy who was holding an MP5 at the time. And he was able to jam the MP5 into this operator, the second operator, and the second operator was there. The number one operator's in there fighting for his life. You know, it just went on. It just turned into a huge problem. They got out of it. It worked out okay, but nobody's ever been able to figure out what they could do in a scenario like that. Anything they had tried really didn't do much better. This guy, to his credit, before it was even over. And he's not seen action at this point, what, 16, 17 years? And he's not, you know, up on the latest nomenclature of weapons or anything like that. He lines up all these guys, and I'm talking like the legends of the SEAL teams at the time, lines them all up, replicates the whole thing again. The guy goes to simulate the attack. He looks at him and he tells the guy, he goes, pull back and sit down. And all the guy did was, when the guy grabbed his weapon, this guy just dropped his body weight, pulled in, cleared the door so everybody could get in, and the weapon went centerline right on to the bad guy. Right then, in one simple move. So I always tell people that, because the reason he got in had nothing to do with punching and kicking or traditional fighting. It had to solve a combat problem that came in and required movements. And the talent that this individual had was he could see arcs and angles. He wasn't formally educated, but he could see arcs and angles that nobody sees. And so that immediately signed him up. They signed him up right away. We did a pilot program, and we were really one of the first to ever get actually credentialized, you know, in the Joint Special Operations community for a system of hand-to-hand training.
Wow, it's an amazing story. Kind of reminds me, takes me back for a couple things, I guess. I have images for some reason of Apocalypse Now about that guy. But aside from that, it's interesting because I know the other podcast I had mentioned to you before the show, Stories of Special Forces Operators, I interviewed a couple of guys who were SOGs. And that's amazing when you hear their stories and how young they were.
Well, yeah, that's just it. When I think back to how young I was and how much they expected me, and the guys around me that I thought were so old, they're like early 30s, you know, and it was crazy. And then some of the older guys from NOM were like maybe 40s, you know, at that point we thought they were dinosaurs. You know?
I know, I'm 50. That's what they treat me like.
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys have phones? Yeah, we did, actually. So psychologically, let me ask you this, Tim, it's obviously my bread and butter a little bit, is
right.
You sounded extremely tenacious, and you sounded you never looked at failure. This is one of the things we've talked about in other shows with SOF individuals. We talked with athletes, Olympic athletes that I've interviewed in the past, or professional athletes. And one thing I always noticed is that if they have an obstacle to their goal, that's all it really is. They just kind of move it aside and keep going. They never right. take their eye off the goal. If you read the Bible, you know, Paul said it, never take your eye off the prize. Whatever it is, that kind of keeps going. And it seems like you did the same thing. You always seem to, if something, any challenge came, I'm assuming you probably reorientated or reframed it and said, okay, this happened, I learned from it and move on. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I got introduced. I really haven't made this connection, but it is true. My mom was she wasn't necessarily a hippie, but she was really into the 70s. Like we were the kids that went to school with whole wheat bread. And, you know, she just was that mom, you know, that came in. But she had a lot of books around the house. One was a yoga book. And another one was, I remember it was Super Learning. It was, these two people. And all I got from both of those were meditative practices and that I read about, you know, because there was the wealth of information we have today with podcasts and everything. It's just amazing. I mean, I would have killed for it back then, but back then you had to really research and you had to go in. And so I did a lot of reading and I got a lot out of it. And just from a mindset standpoint, you know, learning to relax your body. In the Super Learning book, they had a thing where you could, you know, breathe, relax. It's basically tension control, release, very basic by today's standards, but very effective. And I found that when I applied my mind in that way and just visualized things, there was nobody guiding me on this or anything. This is just a deep desire, you know. And I think being a Navy kid, we move around a lot, you know, and so we're constantly in libraries and reading and we're immersed. And I'm in a community, which isn't really the way it is today. But back then, you were an insulated kind of Navy community. You were living on bases, you know. So my dad's not around. I'm being raised by Marines and other people that are around. There are baseball coaches. They're doing, you know, wrestling, boxing, all that stuff. So I was kind of immersed in it without really understanding how immersed I was in it, and picking up mindset from those guys. You know, how a coach would talk to you, how a Marine coach would talk to you is probably very different than a just true civilian coach would talk to you. You know, they were, you know, they'd motivate the hell out of you. But I think where you're getting that is, yeah, I just never... what I always wanted to do, and the reason that the story I told you about going to selection and you only up against 2,500 for two slots, the reason I flew to DC and did that, stayed at my buddy's place, is I knew that was the last thing I could possibly do. I'd done everything else. And that, you know, if I was going to not get one of those slots, it wasn't going to be because I didn't do everything I possibly could do. And what's interesting about that, which I didn't share, I'll just share it real quick. So I didn't get in there right away. Like, I came to the office on a Wednesday and they made me sit. I got there right at 8 a.m. And the commander who was in there, he goes in his office. I had tried to butter up his secretary. She was more than that. She's an administrative assistant. She'd been there for 25 years. So she knew everybody. You know, Margaret was the key to everything. And she liked me, but she sat me down on the thing. She was, I don't know if he'll be able to see you today. I said, okay. I sat there. They made me sit there all day Wednesday. Nothing. No acknowledgement either, you know? So I wouldn't go to lunch just in case, you know, come to lunch, and I couldn't eat anything there because you can't eat in the office. And so, you know, I'm just sitting there, you know, just white knuckling it all day. Thursday, same thing. Friday, 4:45. I've been there all day Friday.
Oh, geez.
He pops his head out. He goes, "Midshipman, you're still here?" And I'm like, yeah. Yes, sir. He goes, "What? I need you out of my office. Just come in here. What do you need?" And so I sat there and he goes, "You got 5 minutes." And I go, "Okay, sir." I said, "Listen, I know you got a huge decision to make. You got 2,500 people. We all look the same on paper. I just want you to know that I won't quit." And he goes, "That's it?" "Yes, sir." He goes, "You flew out here and sat out here for a couple of days. Just tell me that. Just sat in my office, wasting space in my office. Tell me this." "Yes, sir." He goes, "All right, midshipman, you said it." Dismissed. Boom. I go out of the office. I'm like, oh man, I screwed up. Oh, this is
that's what I was thinking, right? I
just sunk myself, you know. And I'm like, oh shit, you know. And so I'm walking down, it's in the Navy building, which is not the Pentagon, it's another huge, just soulless bureaucratic place. And I'm walking out of the office, just one of the drab halls that they have. And I got halfway down the hall and I heard this, "Midshipman Larkin," this JG who had been in the office, he's running down and he's trying not to laugh. And he comes up to me and goes, "Hey man," he goes, "we couldn't do it to you." He goes, "I just wanted you to know, you had it after the first day. We just wanted to see how long you'd stick around."
No way.
So that was my intro to tenacity and stuff. But it was great. And, you know, and then of course the incident of blowing your ears after going through all of that was tough. And I really, that really stuck with me for a long time, because of course it's a shark's nest in there, you know, when you're going through buds and then teams and then, oh man, weakness is just, you're a pariah, you know, you just, nobody wants to touch you. They're very superstitious about that. So that was an interesting transition. And that's why being put in this command, though, what you realize is I definitely went through a different path. The path I ended up going down, I had no business going down it. I was way too junior to be in the path I was in. And I was exposed to way things far beyond any of my contemporaries when it came to access to the special operations community, you know, because we were at such a high level and the Admiral would send me out as a representative and come back. So it made for an amazing career. And it also... it got me to understand other parts of the military and why there were, before it was just all very tribal, very parochialized. This is pre Gulf War, but Panama was a real, which I was involved in tangentially, was a real wake up call for us, because we realized all of a sudden, like, you know, the Navy can't talk to the Army can't talk to the Air Force can't control. And we had so many things that happened in Panama, a place that we had been in for almost 90 years. And it was just a huge problem. And that's when Joint Special, the US SOCOM came around in 1987, and we went quote unquote purple. And that's when I started going around and making all my connections with those groups, which later in my life really helped when I was in the private military contracting side. You know, I had a lot of assets I could draw from and relationships I could draw from. So what I thought was, the worst thing that could ever happen to me is a young 20, I just turned 22, actually was a huge turning point in my life. And it all comes down to this idea of injury to the human body, which obviously is what I teach now to people, as far as I see it, as far as physical self-protection as being your Rosetta Stone to, you know, self-protection, basically. Because if you understand where to put effort on the human body to get a result, you can bypass bigger, faster, stronger. But to your original question about all of this, the reason I wrote the book and the reason I wanted to get it out there, which is really interesting, people like to talk about mindset and they like to talk about, you know, how to prepare yourself. I'm actually the exact opposite. I find it less effective if I really want to change behavioral, you know, probably, because that's my goal with everybody. My goal is not to make my clients into super ninjas or great fighters or anything like that. What I want them to walk away with is a behavioral change where they look at how they led their life prior to training with me. And after they've trained with me, they take steps to minimize the chance of violence ever coming into their life, because that's really the goal. The goal is not to, you know, whatever macho fantasies some people have about, you know, fighting, I take that out of them pretty quickly. And what I find is if I can physically immerse them in a kinesthetic experience that is controlled, they're not, because I can't, if you do it chaotically or you do it solely fear tactics, you know, people call it pressure testing and stuff. If you do that too early in the process, you're going to lose people. And that's not my goal. My goal is not to lose them, but I'm going to methodically train, you know, accurately and correctly show them how to use violence to save their own life. What's interesting is the change that it takes in people. They sit there and go, wow, if I ignore all the situational awareness stuff that, you know, you were talking about and bringing up that are so right, the only thing I'm going to have left is this tool. And look what I have to do to somebody to survive it. And by the way, I don't have a choice, you know, because I'm very clear on how we lay things out. I talk about all the avoidable, we call it antisocial aggression. And then the unavoidable, which is asocial violence, meaning imminent grievous bodily harm, had you a way to get away, talk your way out of it, run, exit, apologize, use any of your community. It's all done now. You know, that all could have happened over here with the antisocial aggression side, where you can still use communication skills. You can still lead. You can still get yourself out of there. And educating people to understand the difference between those two is probably the biggest gift I could ever give anybody. And the most feedback I get from people that I love is, and I do for my operators and for my police units and stuff, when they come back and tell me how they use the physical aspect of the training and how it was effective for them and, you know, save lives or whatever, that's great. I expect them to do well. That's their job. It's when I have a civilian that comes back to me, who's living a great life, who sits there and says, hey, Tim, thank you so much. The old me would have done this. In the situation, I was in the situation the other day, the old me would have done this. I recognized it was going asocial and I got myself and my family out of there. You know, thanks. To me, that's the goal to go for this stuff. Because when people try to glorify violence or they try to make it like there's something great about it, it's not. Violence is good for one thing and one thing only, shutting down communication. You know, you can shut off communication with the other person. And don't get me wrong, when you need that ability, it's absolutely essential, but it is a very rare, I make it a very rare, the way I explain violence is I make it very crystal clear that the high threshold that has to be met before you'd ever be justified or ethical in using the tool.
Absolutely. I'm typing up questions here as you're talking, as a lot of these are popping up in my head. Some comments I'll just make. It's interesting because I saw that tenacity in your book as I was reading it. I could tell by your personality, the way you were writing, and you were trying to get that message across to people of how important it is when you're in this violent situation. So some of the things I've noticed in the book was that message you got across to people. Like the story you talked about, the college girl that you met her when she was younger, I think it was. And then later on, she contacts you later. Do you remember who I am? And then she tells you that incredible story, which is a pretty powerful story. She has that assault, the assailant on top of her. And then she ends up doing what she does. You have to read the book, folks. When Violence is the Answer by Tim Larkin, to get that whole story. But as another point you made too, which is really important, I talked to a professor who looks at violence and the causes of violence in a lot of times in these crimes. And he said over 70% of the time, it's a conflict that could have been avoided if they just de-escalated or just left. And people aren't doing it, but he keeps seeing it. Yeah, there's gang stuff, but even they could reduce their violence if they had walked away. Yeah. And they didn't. My other comment is kind of worthless now, but it's a little too far away. It was just about 1989, and I think the soft guys were in there, Noriega, and took them out. So I can tell they definitely got their act together when the operation, I think it was Operation Just Cause.
Yes.
When they got rid of Noriega, yeah. So that definitely was pretty effective. It was only like 5 days, I think.
Yeah, but we lost on Petite Airfield, we lost more SEALs in 1 day than we had lost all of Vietnam. There are lots of other things, lots of other screw-ups that never should have happened. Marines were dropped into waist-high mud. You know, this is unfamiliar territory for us. We had been in Panama for 90 years. And there's just some unthinkable stuff that we got away with. And yes, ultimately we achieved the goal that we were trying to achieve, but it was a pretty high price to pay for not being prepared.
Yeah, reminded me a little bit of, that part reminded me a little bit of Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing stuff, but let's go back again. So highlight that part's really important because I keep seeing this over and over again in society today in these videos you see all over social media where individuals just keep going up, and escalating within seconds. Now they're emotionally reactive. These individuals are not even contemplating what their actions are going to bring them in regards to consequences. So tell us a little bit more about that. You teach that, but you also, I guess that's my other point. When you were talking about the people you had coming to your camp, the instructors and all those in the beginning, I've noticed a big shift over the last few years, especially we have much more combative forms of jiu-jitsu, combative forms of Krav Maga. It's gotten away because I think a lot of people were stuck with, MMA fighting, this will help on the streets, when it doesn't really apply really well.
Right.
Tell me what you think of your opinion is about this level now, and we'll go into the combative stuff in a minute, but this level of people just getting into fights all of a sudden when they could have just walked away.
I think a lot of it, what's happened in the last, just the last year and a half, has really just been insane. I think during, the Trump presidency, this is not a red or blue statement. It just happened to be during his years. I think the way the media, social media world, everything handled that as a mobilization, it really polarized the country. Whereas before, even when Obama was in and you had the Tea Party and everything, it never got, discussion didn't get shut down. There weren't these vitriolic, things. I mean, I know people have lost friends over all of this just from communication. And so I think that translates now. Of course, you put COVID on top of that, you put the lockdowns in there, and then you put this intense just reliance on social media to communicate. And it translates. I do videos all the time on my YouTube channel, and I did one recently of some sports events, which were just ridiculous. Just people getting triggered over nothing. And not realize that it's my job to bring people back to reality and to sit there and say, listen, you live in a physical world and you don't want to be reminded of that in the wrong way. I tell people all the time, I said, I am a highly capable individual. I mean, I've been doing this for over 30 years. I had to pressure test myself. I've had many instances where I've had to use it because I was devoid of choice. But a lot of that was because of the positions I put myself in. I was a private military contractor. I did, jobs like that. In the civilian world, pretty much I operate like everybody around me who I do not know is 6 seconds away from a shooting spree, and I don't want to trigger it. So how am I going to talk to that individual? Because I know nothing about them. I know nothing about their background. I spent enough time in corrections learning about the top alpha predators and learning about, the prison gangs and how they utilize violence and the tool and everything and how they, what their mindsets are like, to realize that you cannot, you have no way of knowing who's who when you're out and about walking. And so my default is always going to be politeness. It's always going to be, if I have a choice, the choice is always going to be to disengage. It's just because I understand what the ramifications are. I understand if I'm going to flip that coin, you know, it doesn't give me any guarantees. You know, once you cross the physical plane, you put your hands on somebody, you have no idea where it's going to end up. You know, recently I did one about a girls hockey coach in Milwaukee, and he had a guy, he was in the bathroom at a bar. When I say bar, it sounded to me more like, in the way it looked, it didn't look like a bar where everybody's just drinking. It looked like a bar restaurant type place, you know, that you go, not like some seedy bar or something. It looked like a normal place you'd probably go that happened to have a bar. He's in the men's bathroom. Some guy comes in. They had COVID restricted bathrooms where they had like plastic over some of the urinals. Guy comes in, obviously he's had a couple of drinks. He's mad, and he just rips the COVID, you know, blocker on there and just uses the urinal, and he's complaining the whole time and everything. This coach sits there. He'll hears it all. Doesn't say anything, you know, goes in. It bugs him though. It really bugs him. He really wants to say something, and he goes back to his thing. Now this is a guy who trains girls hockey coach. Everybody says what a great guy he was. Never knew him to raise his voice at anybody. Well, apparently they were leaving at the same time, and for whatever reason, this coach had to say something. This guy said something on the way out. This coach followed up, you know, like, hey, you shouldn't be like that. They get into it in the parking lot. They go back and forth. This guy just hauls off, hits the coach. The coach falls back down a flight of stairs at, I guess, like by a parking lot. So boom, that's it. Dead. You know, over nothing. One punch over nothing. I tell people now, that is one of probably 1,000 stories I had over the years. One of my instructors used to collect newspaper cuttings about that, about two guys, just, they have an exchange. One pushes the other cracks his head, bleeds out. That's it, you know, and you're in there. That's how it can happen. But the other problem is that I see too, are the other examples where I have posted, you know, epic bar brawls where guys get into it, and they do, and they beat each other pretty severely, but not beyond, you know, they get up at the end basically, but it's a real beat down. And what I do is I put that against another video, same type of scenario, same types of players, one hit, boom, dead. And so my whole thing is, hey, do you want to flip that coin? You know, because you could be on either side of that. And over what, you know, what I talk to people all about is the 3-day rule. And it's the concept of 3 days from now, the incident that you're talking about, if you find yourself in a jail cell or 6 feet under, would you tell yourself at 3 days later that, yep, there was nothing else I could have done. I had to react to this. You know, very few things make that threshold. And I try to talk to people within the context of showing them how to destroy the human body, because I'm very clinical about it. I'm very like, hey, nope, this is exactly what you need. This is what you're doing. We talk about the functionings within the human body, how you're shutting down the CNS. I don't hold back anything that way. But then when I pull them back, I say, okay, now think about all the unnecessary risks you're taking in your life right now. You know, I'll show them. One of the ones that usually gets people is I'll show an ATM attack. It's an older couple. And I play it and I don't say anything about it. I ask people, well, what do you think happened? Why do you think that happened? They go, oh, well, you know, the situational awareness was wrong. You know, they're both looking at the ATM. The husband should have been out looking away. Now, this is an older guy with a limp, you know, and not in great shape. Neither is the wife. They're in there. Boom. And they had all these great things of how he could have countered this, or if he had this or he had that. Nobody looked at the timestamp. It was 10:30 at night. How many times do you think they've done it and gotten away with it? Yeah. Whereas they didn't want to get up 15 minutes earlier in the morning and go when the statistics are much more in your favor that anything's going to happen. No, they felt it was their right. And honestly, it should be their right to be able to do that safely. But the world isn't the way we want it to be. The world is the way it is. And, you know, when I say that to people, they, oh, you know, these people like to say, oh, shouldn't be able to, you know, shouldn't have to think that way and do it. I go, well, yeah, you can, but that's not my job. My job is to prepare you for what's real. This could have been easily avoided by just getting up 15 minutes earlier, you know, and doing it in the morning. What was so important at 10:30 at night that you needed to get cash out and you're already compromised? You have a bad knee, you're overweight, your wife's not in good health. And I mean, it was a pretty severe beating these people got. And I've got lots of video of people taking unnecessary risks. And the problem is they get away with it. And the term, the analogy I use that usually gets through to people is I said, it's, you know, what you people are all doing is you're sleeping with your head on the railroad track. And last night, the train didn't come. In fact, it hasn't come for how many ever years you've been doing this. So it's fine. The problem is you think the train's never coming. My goal is to just get you to take your head off the railroad track, and then you don't have to worry about this, you know? And that's really it. You know, it's minimizing, it's taking everything you can to minimize the chance of having violence come into your life. And it really isn't that difficult. I mean, basic situational awareness, basic just understanding the stats, you know, most people don't live a criminal lifestyle, so they're not going to come in contact willingly with people like this. And the goal is to just have a predator look your way and just say, yeah, too much work, and go on. Cause they're not looking for a challenge. They're looking for an unaware person that they can easily take advantage of. And if you take some just basic steps in your life, you know, it'll really take you out of that target list.
That's a great point. I mean, I don't know how many times, sometimes I'll do lectures on neurobiology of threats and things of that nature. And, you know, I'm sure you heard it a million times too. And people say, well, you're being kind of paranoid, or which is actually the wrong use of the word anyway, but this hypervigilance and all this other stuff, and, you know, this isn't going to really happen. And I think and sometimes, look, I get it. We don't want, like you said, we don't want the world to be that way. And some people get trapped into that thinking. Yeah. You know, well, I don't think that person means anything. It's okay to let them in, or whatever it is.
Well, and that's the other thing I tell people all the time is, you know, you got to risk embarrassment. You got to risk social awkwardness. If your body, you know, we have so many, I mean, I'm no expert in this, but we have the body communicates us non-verbally so much more than we even understand. And if we, in your situational awareness, if something just keeps telling you, hey, something's wrong here, just go with it. You know, it might make no sense whatsoever. You might look ridiculous, but you're still alive, you know, and people just don't trust that. And it's funny, and I get it after the fact. And when people come to me, the reason I like to do podcasts like this and write books and get the message out is because by the time people come to me, it's usually a 70-30 split. 70% of the people have had violence in their life, some form of it, you know, and I can't undo what's already been done. You know, and so my hope is that I'm getting out to maybe the 30%, you know, in my world out there, as many potential 30%ers are out there. So they hear the message early on and it resonates with them, you know, and you can learn from it. Now, not everybody's like that. I understand that. But you're absolutely right. It's not being paranoid. It's being in tune. It's understanding. Women have a huge advantage over men. Women are far more in tune with their nonverbal and just something not feeling right coming in. And it's not a sexist statement or anything like that. They're just far more open to it. You know, oftentimes I will be at places. It'll be my wife or somebody else say, hey, that guy just looks sketchy. And to me, it never would have bothered me. It wouldn't have been something in my radar, you know, for them. And then I look and I go, oh, yeah, you're kind of right. You know, and so you just make your adjustments. The problem is a lot of times we beat ourselves up because we think we're being either prejudicial, we think we're being uncompassionate, you know, we're making assumptions. But if your body's telling you, you know, you get that queasy feeling in your stomach, or you get the chills or something like that, you know, what's the word? What is the worst thing that's going to happen if you, you know, fall into that? You know, you might be a little embarrassed. You might, you know, have to come back later, do something. But again, you avoided the chance of violence coming into your life at that point while you still had choice.
Yeah. Don't worry about looking like an a-hole or a jerk, because it could save your life sometimes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Tim, what's the name of your YouTube channel?
It's really easy. It's just Tim Larkin. Tim Larkin YouTube channel.
Again, folks, the book is called When Violence is the Answer, Learning How to Do What It Takes When Your Life is at Stake, by Tim Larkin, L-A-R-K-I-N. If you're listening, and look, I know you can't see Tim if you haven't seen him. You know, he looks imposing. And here's a person telling you the same thing we've heard from other individuals. If you can, just walk away.
The imposing thing. People tell me this all the time. Well, yeah, you know, you look the part and everything. I tell everybody, I go, if this is avoiding if whoever's looking at me is looking at my physical build and saying, oh yeah, I don't want to deal with that, that's not the threat I train for. You know, the people, believe me, the people that I know about, they wouldn't hesitate whatsoever. It would just, it would be very, very methodical how they'd come down that way. And that's a harsh thing for a lot of people to understand, because they think there's some innate, I mean, the Hollywood crowd does this all the time. The real guys that are circulating amongst the protected celebrities are not usually the big ex-football players you see out front. There's a whole other group that's kind of just going around looking for the threat at that time. And that's just it. You know, physical presence is good, but it works on everybody we don't care about. And that to me, I've always had that drilled in my head.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of times people don't realize that, especially if you mix drugs and alcohol with it for that perpetrator, right?
Yeah.
That changes the whole ballgame, because now they're not even thinking clearly. They're compromised. So they may even look at you and say, you think you're so tough. Things switch all of a sudden when you're like, he wouldn't have been this. He would have been much more inhibited if he wasn't drunk or on something. But now that he's not, that he is disinhibited, yeah, it leads to a problem. Great advice. Let me ask you this question. As I was mentioning earlier, I'm seeing a shift. You know, MMA is great, and it's got its place, and jiu-jitsu and all these different techniques, and you've learned a lot of techniques, but it seems to be evolving. Just like you mentioned that the guy with the Hawaiian shirt and down in San Diego, he was teaching something that this is practical stuff we have to train for. You know, you can't go around with the little referee calling time and whatnot in the middle of the street. Do you think, what would you recommend for people to do in regards to combat training? I've obviously go to you. I'm not sure if you teach combat training as well.
Or is it, yeah, I mean, I have seminars and all that, and you can go. I mean, if people like this, if they go to timlarkin.com, I have a free masterclass that's there, and it is a free masterclass that talks about all these types of subjects to help you make better decisions on where you want to go for training. Right. I'd suggest that, but the main thing is, just understand, in this, I live in Las Vegas. I have a ton of friends in the UFC that are not only in the business, they're the fighters. I've got tremendous respect. I love combat sports. But what everybody has to understand is, the only way you can make combat sports great is to gamify violence. And the way you gamify violence is you take out direct injury to the human body. And last time I looked at the rules for the UFC, 28 of the 31 rules were direct injury to the human body. And that is not the same out in the street. And I have shown many things, not to put down fighters or anything, but I've shown fighters on the street not understanding the difference of what they were facing, you know, because you get to pick the time when you're going to fight, you know, the person you're going to fight, you're going to probably have background tape on them. You're going to know that that's the only threat you have to worry about. And there's going to be somebody in the ring making sure that all the adhered to rules or agreed upon rules are adhered to. And there's going to be time. And you get that on the street. None of that happens. You have to assume what I always assume for all my clients. You know, you're going to be attacked by multiple attackers. Those attackers are going to be bigger, faster, and stronger, and they're going to carry weapons. And if that's, you know, that's your baseline, you train very differently. The environment dictates what you're going to end up doing. You know, like, people will say, well, BJJ is everything, you got to go. Well, hey, BJJ is awesome. And I would say, hey, one-on-one, yeah, you've chosen a pretty good, you know, method there, but that's just one method. BJJ in a group setting, going to the ground, most of the BJJ guys I talk with, oh my God, it's a nightmare. That's where most people end up getting kicked to death and all the deployed body weight. You might have the one guy, but you don't have to worry about just one guy. You've got more there. So again, it's not that one thing is better than another. It is understanding what tool do you need for the environment that you're in, and really learning, you know, in the combatives world and everything. I think the most important thing is going from brain and body, transitioning to a tool, be it a impact weapon, a edged weapon or whatever, and then to a firearm, and then being able to go back. But the key is making sure that you understand, and it's not a trite saying, that you have one weapon and one weapon only, and that's the human brain. And everything else is ancillary after that. You've got your immediate tools that you have on your body, and then you have ancillary tools that you can use. But it's your brain that drives everything. And your greatest threat that you're facing is another active human brain, not that. So as long as the other person has an active human brain and they are fully engaged, then they're going to continue to be a problem for you. And that's why we talk about injury to the human body, because putting enough trauma into an area of the human body where the human brain is disengaged because it doesn't have control over the body at that time. The body's gone into a reflex that has to try to protect itself. And that's how you learn to take advantage of the human body and take the guy's, you know, greatest weapon away from him.
We got about 10 or 12 minutes. Again, folks, you go to timlarkin.com. Tim, it's interesting. You mentioned not going on your back. I interviewed a Green Beret a while back ago, Alan Shabaro, a really nice man. And he trains jiu-jitsu as well. But it was interesting because he did jiu-jitsu before he went to SOF. And what he found out was interesting is he said, well, shoot, well, I was in the middle of combat in an actual situation. He had somebody on the ground. I can't remember the whole story. He had his knee on the person. The guy flipped him over on his back. And he realized, I can't be on my back. I have grenades on my vest in the front and stuff like this. This isn't going to work here. I got to get this guy off of me. And that's when he started changing the mentality of how he taught jiu-jitsu, because he said, you know, this isn't going to work in certain environments. It just doesn't work. It's kind of like what you insinuated now.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way I found that when I ask guys, especially military guys, what it is about jiu-jitsu, there's a lot of positive. Don't get me wrong. All my kids are learning jiu-jitsu. I think it's great. I want my girl, I have twin daughters. I want to make sure they're used to people grabbing them. And, you know, there are some great instructors out there. But what was interesting from the combat environment was when you ask guys, okay, hey, when was your first time you saw it? And what was it that motivated you? I said, well, you know, we just come off a mission. We had a bunch of POWs that we had, you know, from these guys, you know, bad guys that we had to tie up. And there's this one guy and all four of us were trying to hold him down. We couldn't, he was squirming. We couldn't get him. We couldn't get the cuffs on him or anything like this. And then little senior chief so-and-so comes over, spider monkeys up on the guy and, you know, has him under control right away, you know, doing jiu-jitsu. Oh, we all got to do this now. And what I've heard is every story is usually around some sort of an issue where you had to control a person after the fact and get them into custody or do something. And that was the impressive thing to see a much smaller person take down somebody who multiple guys were having trouble holding on to. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, you got to think of that environment. They control the environment. There were four other of his teammates around him while he was, you know, going on this one guy. Now you take that type of scenario and you take it into what happened to Marines. I believe it was Kabul, outside of Kabul, years ago. This is probably right around the time of, like, you know, Fallujah was over and in Iraq, but things were lighting up over in Afghanistan. A Marine gunny sergeant sent me this article, and it was about a heroic young Marine. There was a car stop. They an IED had just gone off. This car is driving away. There's three Marines get out of their vehicle, stop this guy in a road check, draw down, tell everybody to put their hands up. The first two guys in the car, the passenger side and the driver's side, they comply. They do exactly what's saying. The guy in the back, though, he's squirrely. He's not doing it. So the third guy goes around, goes in, he pulls in, tells the guy, you know, boom, this guy jumps out at him right away, jumps out, and they get into this whole big, you know, knockdown, drag out, you know, attack. The two other guys that are drawing down, what are they doing? They're watching it. You know, they're watching their guys, but they're also watching it. And it was after the fact. What happened was the guy that jumped out wasn't trying to just wrestle and fight with this guy. He was trying to get to a grenade on him, which he successfully got. He got his grenade and he started the process of using the grenade. This guy sees it, that's wrestling with him last minute, throws himself on top of both of it and saves his two buddies from this thing going off, gets a medal posthumously. The article talks about how brave the guy was. The gunnery sergeant that sent it to me, he goes, now here's what they didn't write. He said, when the Marines were briefed after, and they go, hey, you saw the guy jump out of the car after him. Why didn't you engage? Why didn't you go over there and help him engage? They said, oh, because he was winning. Meaning they saw it as a match, a combat match. on there. And these guys were trained because McMaps, which is what the Marine Corps does, it's they like it. The problem with I have with military in some of their training is it's not training for the mission. It's training for esprit de corps. It's a, which is, I understand that, but you shouldn't mix the two. Meaning if you have somebody who is just trying to kill you, you have to respond in kind. And when you're at that level, you don't want to try to be submitting him or controlling him in a situation where you're like that. And that's the danger of the gamification of violence, is that you will default to what you train. There's a very famous special operator in Australia, Paul Kale, and JJ, he goes by JJ, and he came and trained with us for a while. And he talks about a thing. He's very decent in jujitsu. And he talks about being in Afghanistan, going through, getting caught up with this guy. He's trying to stab him and he breaks. He goes, I had him in a Kimura, which is like a double wrist lock. I snapped his arm. He said, didn't matter. The guy was still fighting. He almost got it. He goes, I grabbed my knife and he goes, I killed him with my knife. And Paul has like the first knife kill for Australian Special Forces since Vietnam. But he talked about it. He goes, that's the last time I did martial arts. When I was out there, he goes, I'm not there to compete. He goes, these guys aren't trying to compete with me. And he goes, that was a real bad habit for me to fall into. So again, what I try to convey, people are going to say, oh, you're putting down these sports. No, I'm not. I come from that. I love it. I absolutely love it. But when you're training for a specific mission, if you're training for real street violence, you know, if civilians come to me and they want to learn to be competitors in the combat sport world, I'm not the right guy. I got lots of great people I can send them to, but that's not what I do. You know, if you want to train for, you know, the potentiality to minimize the chance of, you know, criminal violence coming in your life, yeah, I'm your guy for that. I can absolutely help you with that. If you're traveling to a dicey part of the world where, you know, violence is going to be something, yes, I can help you a lot with that. That's within my skill set. But what I try to tell people all the time, most of what people do when they look for self-protection is they look for the punching, the kicking, the grappling, the weapons, the tools. Those are all tactics. You know, those are all various tactics that are useful. What I try to do for people is I want them to have a strategy. I want them to have a real self-protection strategy. And within that, those things exist, as does situational awareness, as does, you know, different types of preparedness. And then when you have a real strategy, it's much easier to look at things saying, okay, for this particular situation, what tool would be best? And that's really how you just have to soberly look at the situation.
I guess my last comment and last question, my last comment would be something people might have noticed on the show. You know, we recommend self-defense, but just like you, we really recommend, we only bring on honestly, individuals who in the world of jiu-jitsu, Krav Maga, who don't teach competitive. We only bring the ones who teach competitive because those are the ones who learned it. Just like you said, it just doesn't work. I mean, you're spot on that. So I just wanted to make sure the audience realized that too. I don't usually ever bring somebody on who doesn't teach that. If you want to go into competitions, God bless you. Totally different world. As Tim mentions right now, again, it's when violence is the answer. Tim, my last question is interesting because when I've interviewed so many soft guys in the past, and you got as close as you could get, and they obviously trained you already mentally. People think Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Delta, everybody is badass, and they are. they're tough guys. But at the same time, the main thing I've always learned is really about the mind, just like you mentioned. And you seem to be using that kind of same mindset, which is great, which is problem solving. It sounds like that's what's a lot of what you're teaching. And you seem to have got that as well from the Navy SEALs, because that's what I always hear from these guys. They said the best thing I've ever learned in Green and SEER training and BUDS was problem solving. If I got into a problem, it isn't just like, oh, crap, what am I going to do now? It wasn't like that. It was like, okay, what do I need to do? What do I have? What tools do I have? And it sounds so much like your philosophy. Am I off on that?
No, it's there. There's a lot of, it's funny too. I as a young kid, I was living in Virginia Beach, and I was there when Admiral Stockdale came home from the Hanoi Hilton, all the guys came home. And that was my first other introduction to Stoicism, because that's what really helped him. And so as a young kid, I was reading about the Stoic philosophers and how they looked at things. And that is really prevalent. It's getting much more widely read in the military than it used to be. It was his papers were there. Admiral Stockdale actually has some really great papers for young officers on it. I will tell people that, especially when you're facing adversity, Understanding stoicism really helped. It's not what most people think. Most people think it's like this real rigid, you know, you don't care about anybody, you're not affected by anything. That's not it at all. It really teaches you how to problem solve in a very useful way. Meaning, I think most people have a trouble, and I think this is why we get in trouble, is we get so caught up with all the things we have no control over. And we spin around about those rather than looking within and saying, okay, what can I control? Well, I can control my reactions to this. I can control what comes out of my mouth. I can control what I eat. I can control what I do. And I think in the spec ops community, even if they don't say it that way, that's kind of what you're taught. Like, there's a lot of times we got to go do stuff that we don't agree with and we think is going to be really a dumb way of doing it, but you got to do it because you were ordered to do it that way. And so you just say, okay, what can we control? Well, we control how we put our gear together, how we do this, how we do that, you know, how we infiltrate, exfiltrate, all that stuff. And you just learn. I think adversity really helps you. And if I could say anything, you know, people are raising kids or anything, don't limit their adversity. Let them figure things out. You know, I think one of the great things that I had growing up was the fact that I had to figure a lot of stuff out on my own. You know, I had to encourage your kids to read. I think reading is going to be a superpower for people in the coming decades because nobody's really reading, you know, much anymore and really getting in depth. Understanding human nature, especially in the world of self-protection, is absolutely huge. You know, these are the things that will end up saving your life, believe it or not. But the physical part of it is pretty easy to pick up and pretty easy to understand. And you'll know where you stand with that kind of stuff. But if you become really a student of human nature and how people, you know, respond to each other, that's probably your greatest weapon.
That's a great point. Mr. Larkin, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
It was a great time. We have to bring it back, sir. We have to bring it back. Get more into depth into this stuff. And folks, I'll leave you with this. Again, Tim Larkin, his book is When Violence Is the Answer. Also, the other book is Survive the Unthinkable. You can check him out at timlarkin.com, LARKIN, timlarkin.com. Definitely go check it out and see what he has to offer. There are a lot of great training programs. And I'll leave you with this. Tim made a comment earlier on in the interview about the cold showers. If you find yourself in the shower or in the bath, let's say in the shower, it works best, and turning it to freezing cold at the very end of the shower bothers you, it might be time to try to do that and toughen up a little bit and try to deal with a little simple adversity like turning that shower freezing at the end. Actually helps your immune system too. All right, folks, thank you again so much, Tim. Thank you, everybody. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. Go to timlarkin.com.